This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland to tell us about the president's whole new approach to NATO. I'll admit, I kind of like Trump's idea of getting European countries to pay a greater share of their defense costs. Is that all gone by the wayside now?
No, I don't think that's gone by the wayside at all, Dave, to tell you the truth. It's clear for two reasons. One is that this has been a longstanding complaint by U.S. administrations, and you can go back as far as you want. I mean, my first time in the Pentagon when I worked there was in the 1980s. And I recall going to hearings back then, having Democratic and Republican lawmakers and administrations complaining about the fact that NATO countries need us to play more. Second, of course, this ongoing threat posed by Russia, now putting 40,000 troops on the border of Ukraine, an additional 40,000 troops in the Crimea, certainly should be a wake-up call to our NATO allies that things are not what they should be in their particular backyard. And I think that will further urge them to see that they can continue to spend more on their defense.
What exactly are we preparing for there? We're not going to fight Russia over Ukraine, are we?
Well, certainly one would hope not, and one would hope it doesn't come to that. But certainly what we're trying to do right now by Blinken and Austin are on their way, or in Brussels actually right now, meeting with the NATO officials and rhetoric by the administration, is to make sure Vladimir Putin and the Russians fully understand that an invasion of the Ukraine would not come without cost. Don't forget, 7 years ago, 2014, we went through this before when Russia suddenly moved troops into Crimea, claimed they weren't there, claimed they were little green men, but in reality, over time, has acknowledged that they, in fact, did invade the Ukraine and conquer that piece of territory and take it away from the Ukraine. Since then, there's been an ongoing war in the Donbas region, which is the eastern portion of Ukraine bordering with Russia. No doubt about it, Russian troops involved, no doubt about it, Russian military hardware being provided to separatists. And that simmering war now has literally killed tens of thousands of people. And so, once again, they're saber-rattling, and the idea of making sure that there are costs associated should they decide to do something more provocative is what this is all about. And hopefully that will prevent Russia at this time from invading.
Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and Lloyd Austin, the new Defense Secretary, for people who didn't recognize the names there. Okay, so on Iran, their centrifuges were just sabotaged, allegedly by Israel. First of all, do we know that, or are we assuming that it was Israel?
No, we don't know that. Israel does not acknowledge, nor does it reject these type of activities when they occur around the world, particularly, of course, in the Middle East. A lot of U.S. intelligence officials and some Israeli intel officials supposedly have acknowledged privately that Israel was, in fact, involved. More importantly, perhaps, the Iranians have been very outspoken in the public press by their leadership, hanging the blame on Israel and saying, of course, that there will be retribution for the attacks on their Natanz nuclear facility.
And then there's China. I was reading about this meeting in Anchorage last month between our diplomats and the top foreign policy aide to the Chinese President Xi Jinping. And apparently there was the foreign policy guy delivered a 16-minute lecture about America's racial problems and the failures of our democracy to make clear that China sees itself as an equal to the U.S. now, and warned against any challenge to China over any attempt to reunify with Taiwan. So where do we stand versus China now?
Well, there's no doubt about it. If the 20th century, Dave, was the century of Europe, and the United States was involved in three wars in Europe, World War I, World War II, and Cold War, the 21st century will be the century of Asia, and the emergence of China as a major power, second largest economic power on the planet, and most people believe will become the largest economic power on the planet, is emerging. And as a consequence, we see the Chinese flexing their muscles in a number of places, most notably the South China Sea, as they claim several rocks out there, which gives them control over the oceans around that and the perhaps natural resources associated with that. We saw them flex their muscles, of course, in Hong Kong. We've seen them flex their muscles against the Indians and, of course, against the Uyghurs in their own country in Xinjiang province. They have definitely created what we believe to be concentration camps and telling us to mind our own business when we complain about those things. So there's no doubt about it that they are going to assert their position. That being said, the talks in Anchorage, after the public diplomacy was over with and they got their talk in and they got the cameras to cover that, went on for about 6 hours. So some people suggest there was an exchange of views. You know, Dave, what's interesting to me, back to Russia and China, if you talk about Iran, well, we need Russia and China, who are involved in the negotiations in Vienna right now, to see if the United States can return to the Iran nuclear deal, because they're signatories to that. China and Russia will be very, very involved in whether or not the United States can find a peaceful and delicate way to pull its troops out of Afghanistan. And there'll be upcoming negotiations, I think it's next week, in Istanbul, Turkey, in which they'll have representation there. So while we're estranged from these two countries in very serious ways, in the Ukraine and the South China Sea, we need them to solve many of the major problems we confront.
But what stung about that statement, at least for me, was that Chinese officials clearly think we're a wounded giant. Are we?
No two ways about it. They certainly believe that, and they certainly believe, I think, more importantly, that their system works. Yeah. In other words, what they're basically saying is an authoritarian regime and a capitalist economy is what really works in the 21st century, and a democratic society like our own doesn't work. And they want to make that point to us, but when they make that point to us, they're really making that point to a billion Chinese, yeah, because their biggest concern is at home, and they're also making that point to countries, particularly in their periphery, who they are trying to convince, you need to follow our particular way of life and not that one espoused by the Americans.
Well, be honest, are they right? I mean, when it comes to spreading influence around the world, does police state capitalism outmaneuver democratic free market capitalism?
That's the question that the Biden administration says it has to answer over the next couple of years in this particular competition, the competition really of ideologies and how we govern, more so than a competition of economies and military spending. Personally, I still have great faith in democracy. Yes, democracy is messy. Yes, democracy perhaps does not move as quickly at particular moments tactically as authoritarian regimes. But longer term, I still believe democracy will triumph over those regimes which are very brittle. And we see over time that as people become more affluent historically, what do they want? Well, they want more say in how they're particularly governed. And it's interesting, you know, for a country that boasts that it has the best political system, why is it that they have thousands of people policing the internet to make sure that their population can't see certain sites? Why is it, by the way, that they've banned Winnie the Pooh on the Chinese version of the internet? And the reason is because people have compared Winnie the Pooh to Xi Jinping, and he doesn't like that.
CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
Dave, always a pleasure.
This is Seattle's Morning News. All police recruits in Washington State are receiving special training to help prevent the kind of mistakes officers may make under stress. And with the report, here's Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch.
It's called Cognitive Command Training, a program developed by Dr. Jonathan Page.
Our brain really does three things. It perceives, processes, and performs. So we take in information, our brain does something with that, and then we act in some kind of way.
He tells Cairo Radio's Gian Ursula, typical law enforcement training focuses on that last part, officers' actions. Cognitive training emphasizes the first two steps, which helps officers stay in control and de-escalate stressful encounters.
What cognitive training does for law enforcement officers, it slows things down for them in stressful situations so that they can think through things and not just react.
For example, there's a technique called anchoring, setting and controlling an emotional tone in a situation.
But one officer told me about a traffic stop from a person running a stop sign. She said that she set her anchor, giving the person a warning. And when she connected with the person, he turned out to be a real jerk to her. And she said she kept thinking to herself, buddy, you're not going to pull me off my anchor. As long as you don't do something dangerous or illegal, you're just going to get a warning today. So she ended up giving the guy a warning rather than letting it escalate into something bigger.
Recruits can access the training online. The Washington State Legislature is considering making the program available to all officers.
Heather Bosch, that might have helped in Brooklyn, Minnesota, but instead more protests there following the fatal police shooting of Dante Wright. Here's CBS's Omar Villafranca.
As darkness fell on Brooklyn Center, clashes between protesters and police continued outside their headquarters. The unrest followed the release of body cam video showing the moments leading up to Wright's death. After pulling Wright over for an expired registration tag, officers learned he had an outstanding warrant stemming from two misdemeanor charges. When the officers tried to handcuff Wright, he struggled to get back in his car. That's Officer Kim Potter yelling she will tase right. But instead, she's holding her gun, which she then fires. Brooklyn Center Police Chief Tim Gannon.
From what I viewed and the officer's reaction and distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright. I needed to be transparent, and I wanted to be forthright.
Officer Potter has been placed on administrative leave, but some people are calling for her badge, including Mayor Mike Elliott.
We cannot afford to make mistakes that lead to the loss of life of other people in our profession.
People have been asking about what were the outstanding warrants that were against Dante Wright, and from what I'm reading, it was possession of a pistol in a public place and fleeing from police, I guess, when they tried to arrest him for that. But we're still waiting for more details to come in. Choke points. Should the state move or even eliminate the ferry dock at Fauntleroy? All the options are on the table because it needs fixing, and the neighborhood is consistently congested, and Chris is going to explain all this for us.
This Fauntleroy dock was built in the 1950s, and it really should have been replaced years ago. It is a vital link, Dave, as you know, to Vashon Island and to Southworth. It's the fourth busiest ferry route in the system, serving more than 3 million vehicles a year pre-COVID. There are both structural and operational issues with the dock. Director of Terminal Engineering, Dave Sowers, says the old wooden pilings need a seismic upgrade.
They're seismically risky in a big event. We think, in fact, at this terminal, for example, in a moderate earthquake, we could lose parts of the terminal.
And then there's the operational problem. The boats that serve this route carry 124 cars. The dock holding area only has space for about 80.
On a single sailing, you've got, you know, at least 40 to 50 cars just for one boat piled up on the city street, backed up towards Lincoln Park.
And that backup has a huge impact on the community around the dock. So what to do about it?
We're going to look at replacing in kind. We're going to look at, you know, bigger, longer, and we're going to look at relocation. Everything's on the table.
And Sowers says that includes eliminating the West Seattle dock entirely and making runs from Southworth and Vashon direct to Coleman Dock in downtown Seattle as a potential possibility. Again, that's been mentioned. These are just ideas on the chalkboard right now. The ferry service, as you know, just moved the Mukilteo terminal down the road, but there was land nearby that the ferry service could acquire. It doesn't have that luxury in West Seattle.
The state or one of our partners doesn't have a lot of real estate that we can just say, oh, well, there's where we can park 200 cars.
And I don't think the city of Seattle would just volunteer a few acres of Lincoln Park either. Sowers says the ferry service is looking for open-minded community members willing to get their hands in the dirt to figure this out. The ferry service is putting together a community task force to help guide the discussion.
The riders, literally the neighbors, folks in West Seattle, kind of bring them together, talk about what's a good solution, partner with our friends at the city and the county, and come up with the best solution we can. Kind of tackle all of these various issues.
The state is looking for about 20 people willing to spend the next 2 years a solution. Yeah, that's how long it's going to take to go through the environmental and the beginnings process of this. You can find the application at mynorthwest.com. The deadline to submit is April 23rd.
Well, the community advisory group should reflect not just the community around Fauntleroy, but the ridership, folks from Port Orchard and from Southworth, folks from the island. We want it to be a well-rounded group.
Construction for the new terminal is scheduled to be funded by the legislature in the 2025 to 2027 biennium.
You know, we cannot afford to sit around on our hands and wait for this problem to solve itself.
Well, that'll be an interesting project, actually. I would say lengthen it and widen it and then reinforce it, and like they did with the dock on Vashon itself.
Yeah, so you think you could go out deeper into the water there and add more holding area? You think that's probably the best spot as someone who uses that ferry off?
Yes, going downtown, I would not welcome, though.
How about something closer to Terminal 5, kind of where the water taxis are? As a way to get there.
Oh, I see. Well,
if they were to relocate somewhere along, you know,
it's a lot longer trip though. It's a lot more ferry fuel. I mean, make it more expensive.
Yeah, Yeah, so, I mean, these are the things they're looking at. I mean, moving, eliminating. When I heard eliminating and moving, I was like, whoa!
Yeah, that's
going to be very interesting to the folks. I know I follow on Facebook the Vashon Writers Group, and I told them last night, hey, get ready to listen to something very interesting this fourth. And so, yeah, we'll see this.
Well, I know it is very annoying to the community, and during rush hour, I try never to go at rush hour because finding a way into that line is very difficult. That's the only place where I've actually seen people literally try to do something you should never do, which is cut the ferry line. And boy, does that get people mad.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Because then when you get up there, the dock's so small, if you have to wait another boat, you're still there and the people behind you are still mad, which could lead to some issues at the ferry dock. So,
well, I learned the key to not getting mad in the ferry line is not to bother with the ferry schedule. Just make sure you have, and we keep a pretty much a library in the back seat, so there's always a nice long book to read. And then the only problem is to make sure you haven't dozed off by the time it's your turn to turn the engine on and move up in line, which also gets people mad.
Yes, certainly. But, so we'll see. Maybe you should join the community task force.
I don't think so.
You sure?
I don't think so. I would state my opinion, and they'd kick me right out. So.
Very good.
So, sort of like what happens on this show from time to time. So, yeah. We're going to have the official announcement, and it has brought frustration, disappointment, and even defiance because the governor has announced rollbacks for three counties because of COVID infections. And there, of course, is new trouble with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So let's get a roundup from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yep, Governor Inslee announcing yesterday that three counties, Cowlitz, Whitman, and Pierce counties, all came up short on the metrics and will need to roll back come Friday.
Like the people of Pierce County, I think I'm very frustrated at the prospect of the state rolling us back to phase two, particularly when, as opposed to in the wave in December, right, the vast majority of our seniors, the folks who are vulnerable to really bad outcomes, they're vaccinated.
That's Pierce County Executive Bruce Damiar. Now, the decision comes after many business groups sent a letter to the governor over the weekend urging him not to roll any counties back, but instead to double down on the vaccine efforts. But as Inslee said last week,
this is not judgment day. The score is the score. This score is determined by the COVID virus, not us.
Not good enough, says Anthony Anton with the Washington Hospitality Association.
We're disappointed. We were really hoping the governor would have heeded the call we asked for in the letter and taken this moment to unite us around vaccinations. And really, that's where we all need to be focused in the next 3 weeks. We're disappointed because it's going to hurt those small businesses for something that they didn't do. This is really the spring break, the bump that we're seeing right now.
Now, the rollback means that businesses like fitness centers and gyms and others will have to roll back from 50% capacity to 25% capacity. Pierce County businesses and consumers who spoke to Cairo 7 TV were also disappointed.
That's not good.
What's the point of even having anything open? How is people supposed to live? They're putting people more and more out there in the street.
25% capacity
would be like four people.
You wouldn't even put beer in the freezer.
So they're worried about their bottom line and their ability to stay open. The rollbacks come after the governor warned about them on Thursday, then on Friday moved the goal line. He changed it. It used to be that you had to meet hospitalizations and you had to meet the case capacity threshold, and he changed that to just having to meet one, and it moved which county. Without that change, I think King County probably also would have had to roll back. Mm-hmm. And that's raising some questions among people. Executive Damiar down in Pierce County, he questions the metrics.
When you look at our hospitals, they say they have significant capacity to care for anybody who needs care. They don't understand the hospitalization rate problem. The governor's plan says that they evaluate every 3 weeks. But if our numbers come down, you can bet we're going to be calling him every day saying it's time to let us back into phase three.
And he also has issues with the availability of vaccines.
We've been shorted vaccines by 55,000, and doing so when our hospitals have more than enough capacity to take care of anybody who is sick, and doing so when the vast majority of our senior citizens who are vulnerable are vaccinated – I think that gets the majority of people in Pierce County very frustrated. Our population, we're 6% less vaccinated than the state average, and we are almost 10% as a percent of population behind King County. The state has been shorting us vaccines.
So he's saying what would be fairer would be a vaccine push in Pierce County.
Absolutely. And he's also saying, look, this is not what we're hearing from our hospitals. I don't know what you're talking about with this capacity issue. Mm-hmm. And I think Pierce County's rate, the goal is 5 hospitalizations per 100,000 residents over a 7-day period. And Pierce County's is listed under what the metrics they used yesterday as having 6.5 is their rate. So it's just slightly above. But yeah, he's definitely questioning the metrics. They're not happy about that. Now, the vaccine is another issue, as you mentioned, because the U.S. is now concerned about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And it looks like they're going to recommend a pause on using that. That was already taking a hit because of the mix-up on the recipe in the Baltimore lab. Already the DOH said that they were expecting over the next 2 weeks from now a dramatic, more than half cut in our Johnson & Johnson supply. So this, I mean, is going to pause it altogether. That was another almost 9,000 doses we were expecting over the next 2 weeks from there.
So just to understand what Bruce Dammeyer, the Pierce County executive, was saying, he feels that what we're seeing now is the echo of spring break. So that the close down at this point is closing the barn door after the horse is out.
And I think that's what you were hearing from Anthony Anton, who was from the Washington Hospitality Association. Mm-hmm. He absolutely said this is from spring break. It has nothing to do with the businesses. What you're hearing from the Pierce County executive is that, one, our hospitals have plenty of capacity, so why are you shutting us down with this metric that's no good? And then also, you're giving King County all the vaccine they need. You're not giving enough to us. It needs to be more equitable, especially when you hear the governor saying consistently that this is the vaccine effort is being done equitably. The other interesting thing, as I'm sure you've seen, is there's a big push now nationally from some health experts to go to just a single dose, because there's rising cases, not just here, but in other areas. And there's no, because of the way that they made the vaccine so quickly to get it out there, they never really tested to see if you let it go a longer time between doses, if it makes really any difference. And they know that at least one dose protects a significant number of people for a little bit. So there's a big push for that. It would be interesting to see how that plays out.
Right. So on the not getting enough vaccine, is this strictly because of the Johnson & Johnson pause, or I mean, have they not been able to get to the right communities to hand it out? I thought there was plenty of vaccine, I guess is what I'm saying.
And I've not heard of any shortages. I think it's not that there's a shortage of vaccine in the state, although there might be now because of the Johnson & Johnson impact. I know it was a surprise that we didn't get as much after that recipe issue with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And now this new issue is only going to exacerbate that problem with that particular vaccine. But we still have Moderna and Pfizer. So it sounds like Pierce County just doesn't think it's getting its equitable share of that. And so that comes down to how DOH decides to dole that out. The other issue is, in 2 days, everyone 16 and over is going to be eligible for the vaccine. So that certainly can't help matters with if there's issues with people feeling like they don't have enough. And on top of that, only the Pfizer vaccine is good for those who are 16 and older, not the others.
Okay, Hannah, so when is the next evaluation of the metrics take place? And how soon could Pierce County or these other counties get this new restriction lifted and go back to phase 3?
May 3rd is the next numbers check. That's if anything doesn't change. May 3rd. It's 3 weeks. So, and that's if nothing changes, if they don't change the rules between now and then. I have got to tell you, I have heard from so many people who are absolutely just not buying it really anymore at this point because of that change in the metrics that the governor did on Friday. He moved the goal line, and people are upset no matter which side of the issue they're on this, whether they believe it or they don't believe that, you know, they need to be more careful about COVID and they trust the metrics. There's frustration because it's like a flip flop, right? Yeah. And I've heard from gym owners down in Pierce County who say, no, we are not going to reduce capacity. I'm not doing it.
Hannah Scott, thank you.
You bet.
Daily Dose of Kindness now brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company Incorporated. Certainly, we're seeing the best of America in these stories. They say that home is where the heart is. A nonprofit in California putting a whole lot of heart into the homes of wounded soldiers. CBS's Abby Alford has this story.
Homes for Our Troops just broke ground on First Sergeant Ben Holmes's house and next door at another wounded veteran's house.
Dude, that's a lot of yard, bro. Yeah.
Walking with his son, Kyle, Marine First Sergeant Ben Holmes says that these piles of dirt will soon be his adaptable home.
I can absolutely envision it.
Holmes lost his right leg when he drove over an IED in 2011 while serving in Afghanistan.
Figuring out where it impacts you on a daily basis and what I can and can't do was, you know, sometimes painful.
Homes for Our Troops is building a 2,800-square-foot, three-bedroom, two-bath home in Escondido for the Holmes and another house next door for Marine Corporal Keontae Story and his dog, Kuja.
I can raise a family here. My school that I just got accepted to is right down the street as well.
Corporal Story also lost his right leg in an IED explosion while serving in Afghanistan in 2010. Since then, he's climbed at Mount Kilimanjaro, competed in Spartan races and Tough Mudders, and this home will continue to motivate him to live his life to the fullest.
I never let my injury dictate what I was able to do. It was more of, how do I get through this?
The house will have bigger bedrooms, bathrooms, lower countertops, and wider walkways. Since 2004, the nonprofit Homes for Our Troops has built 315 houses free of charge to the veterans paid through donations. Corporal Story and First Sergeant Holmes plan to move into their houses in September.
Very least we can do for our veterans.
Now from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9 here on Cairo Radio, G. Scott, whose father was a police officer, and so every time this happens, we ask you, G, what did your dad tell you?
You want to be right, or do you want to go home?
Yeah.
It was one of the things that it echoes with me, and is something that I talk about with my sons as well. You know, sometimes there are a few topics in which there's a lot of things that we talk about here on Cairo, and sometimes I'll admit I don't go as hard on some of these topics as I might do at home, right? I'm not allowed to swear on the radio either, but I swear at home. I'm going to tell you, sometimes I'll swear to drive home a point. And one of those points is this. First of all, what happened in Minnesota is terrible. Absolutely terrible. There's no way in the world that that young man should be dead. That young man had a warrant for his arrest. You want to know why he had a warrant? He had a warrant because the notice of the Zoom hearing was sent to the wrong address. Yes, he was issued a warrant. But either way, a warrant goes from he is no longer here, he's gone. This is the same state when Philando Castile was killed, and we all saw that on video. After that, all of this money was given and sent out for more training, and we're going to do more. And it's kind of like the money that's put into homelessness problems, and that's never solved. And this is the same thing. And then you see right now during the Derek Chauvin trial, this is going on, and this happens at this time, and this police officer's 26 years she has been on the force. Now, so in my house, this is what I say. If you on one hand agree that there is a problem with policing, especially when it comes to black men, which I do agree with that. I do think that there is a problem. I do think that there's a lot of unconscious bias that happens when police officers pull over black men. So if you believe that, then if you believe that, then the answer to this is do you want to be right or do you want to go home? So I tell my sons, you promise me, I don't care if you're with by yourself, you with your friends, when you get pulled over, it is that cop show, period. You look me in my eyes and you promise me you will never, never, never react or do anything. So again, if I'm telling you that there is a problem, which I do believe that there's a problem. So if there is a problem, then your reaction is, do you want to be right or do you want to go home? And sons, you need to come home to me.
What if you can't help your reaction? Like the Army guy. Remember the Army guy who got maced? He said he was afraid to get it. And he was a trained military officer. He was a lieutenant. Mm-hmm. He was scared to get out.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, it is scary. In Federal Way, almost 20 years ago, I was pulled over. Me and a buddy of mine were pulled over. Guns drawn. Right there off of 320th. Near the barbershop, I'm standing on top. Yes, I'm glad you asked me why. I had no idea at the time, right? I had no clue. All I know is I can see all these police cars, and I can see all the guns. They're having me back up, and they're having me back up the spaces. And so when I get back to them, I put my hands behind my back and put me in the car. Come to find out, they said that my car matched the description of a car that they were looking for and a suspect they were looking for, and this person was wanted. And they went to go look at my chest to see if I had a tattoo on my stomach. I don't have a tattoo on my stomach. That let them know I wasn't that person. So,
but they approached you guns drawn.
Guns
right off the bat.
Drawn.
Oh, man.
So what I'm saying is this. I have many stories where I've been, in my opinion, unfairly done by the police. But at the end of the day, I'm here to tell you this story. So if you're a mom or a dad right now and you're listening, you have a son or daughter, make sure they know. And during that time, during that traffic stop, that cop is their show. It is their show at that time. If you feel that there's a problem, okay, you can report that later. You can have that taken up. You can send notice and all. You can do all that stuff, but during that time, you got to do the right thing. And so, Dave, back to what you're saying with the Army lieutenant, yeah, I'm sure he was scared. I'm quite sure that feeling is something. And luckily, I mean, so much so, and you saw how what happened to him. You saw how they did him and how they maced him and how they talked to him. And by the way, when they talk to you bad, they talk to you bad. I haven't had the police talk to me bad in a long time because I don't know, I haven't been pulled over in a while either. But at the same time, has there been absolutely. Has there been times that they pull me out of the car and check my car for drugs? Yes, I've had that happen before. Dave, you ever had somebody do that before? Handcuff you while they do that?
Never. I've been stopped by an officer who thought I was at Yesler Terrace because I was looking for a drug deal.
Isn't that something?
Because I was a white guy in the wrong place.
I yelled at a cop on Christmas Eve for giving me a ticket, and I didn't get any punishment like that. They didn't draw my gun on me. They didn't say, excuse me, what'd you say, and pursue me. I mean, the privilege it is to be able to yell at a police officer when I was in the wrong.
Yeah. And that's last story, I'll tell you this. When I was younger, my dad would not let me have, when I would drive, he wouldn't let me have anybody in the back seat. That was another rule that he had. And I used to think it was the dumbest rule. Well, anyways, my dad being the investigator that he is, I had some friends in the back seat and he looked at the car and he told me and he took the car away from me. Because he was very strict about me riding with friends and riding with more than one other person. Because that was a problem for him to have that happen.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock with Ursula. Thank you, G. Yep. Tuesday morning, and so it's time to go to everybody's favorite Pulitzer Prize winning Washington Post reporter, David Fahrenthold. David, good morning. And it turns out the people who worship Donald Trump and people who despise Donald Trump have one thing in common. They get mad because we're still talking about Donald Trump. But you say there's a good reason why.
Well, there's two reasons why. One is that he's still basically the central figure of the Republican Party. If you want to talk about the Republican Party, one of our two biggest parties, it's about Trump now. They haven't figured out a way to get past him. Maybe they don't want a way past him. So, you know, he's not elected in anything anymore, but he doesn't have any government power, but he wields a huge amount of political power in that party. The other one is that there's maybe some big legal proceedings against Trump. We've never had a president put on trial ever. And so if Trump is headed that way, either in a civil trial or a criminal trial, it's a big deal. And I want to make sure we're on top of it.
Yeah. You don't have any inkling, though, what those charges might entail, were there to be any.
No, there's three main criminal investigations going on now involving Trump. One is in Georgia about his interference in or attempts to overturn the election there. One is in D.C. about his incitement of the riot. And the third one is this one in the Manhattan DA is running, looking back at Trump's financial practices. That one, from all we hear, is going to be months and months before there's any sort of decision. And that if there's a deadline, it's when the Manhattan DA leaves office at the end of this year. So I don't think any decision's going to come soon.
Yeah. Typically, when a politician gets in this much trouble, people run away like rats from a sinking ship. But he's managed to hang on to his. In fact, it appears as if Mar-a-Lago has become sort of the Trump Vatican, or maybe even the Republican Vatican, because people are making pilgrimages there. What? I guess you would argue to spend money, to deliberately spend money at a Trump facility?
Well, the biggest reason they go there is because he doesn't leave. He's the central figure in this party, but he basically never leaves his house. He doesn't leave his house except to go play golf at one of his courses. And so if you want to see Trump and get your picture with him and, you know, have some FaceTime with him, you go there. And so not everybody pays. Some people just show up and have a meeting with him. But a lot of people are paying. They're paying to rent the ballroom, rent one of the side rooms, to have a big fundraiser there. And, you know, you understand the logic. If you're going into a Republican primary and either you're an incumbent or maybe you're somebody's trying to knock off an incumbent, you need Trump's stamp. And so the best way to get it is to go pay him some money and rent out one of his ballrooms and hope he drops by.
So who runs the Republican Party now?
Well, in theory, it's this person, Ronna McDaniel. She is the RNC chairman, but she was installed by Trump, and she seems to be going to great lengths to placate Trump. So last weekend, they were supposed to be having an RNC donor retreat at another place in Palm Beach. And because of Trump, they moved one of the big dinners to Mar-a-Lago. So they spent a ton of money at Mar-a-Lago, more than $100,000, just to placate him and to let him speak for like 90 minutes, which most of which was a rant about, you know, Mitch McConnell and the 2020 election and all that stuff. So she's subordinated her, both given her money, her attention, her time, her donors, put them all at Mar-a-Lago in the hopes of placating Trump.
Explain the Mitch McConnell thing. If he's trying to get – McConnell is up, in 2 years?
McConnell is up in 2022, yes.
2022. So if they get rid of McConnell, who takes his place?
I think you're applying strategy and logic to a situation that really may not call for it. I think Trump doesn't like McConnell because he feels like McConnell should have supported his effort to overturn the election. So he's grousing about that and calling McConnell some bad names. I don't think anybody believes there's going to be a primary challenge to Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, or if there is, it'll succeed. So that seems to be like hot air. But the Republicans really want Trump to be nice to their incumbents, people like Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, other folks who are running for re-election, and not basically bring a crazy challenger that might lose in the general.
Well, what about Mike Pence? What's his future?
Well, Pence is laying pretty low right now. I mean, as are basically a lot of the people who see themselves as post-Trump political candidates. Pence has gone back to Indiana. He just hasn't made any public appearances. He certainly hasn't gone to Mar-a-Lago or had any contact with Trump. Trump seems to have basically written him off as, you know, not insufficiently loyal. Hmm. So, you know, Pence was the vice president. If he wants to be the president, you know, he needs Trump to get off the stage because I don't think he has the clout to beat Trump. And certainly while Trump is out there choosing who their leaders are, he's never going to choose Mike Pence.
Yeah. Now, is Trump actively running for president, do you think?
I guess it depends on how you define active. He certainly hasn't ruled it out, and he's certainly talking about in vague terms running again. But, you know, he's not articulating. In these speeches that he's made, he's not articulating any sort of real vision for what comes next. You know, what would it be like?
Well, but that's not necessary because he is the vision, right?
Right. But, like, I guess if you're aiming at an audience of beyond the Republican faithful, you know, people, you know, in 2016, people forget, like, he had a platform. He wanted to build a wall. He wanted to, you know, stop immigration from certain groups. It wasn't a platform a lot of people liked, but it was a platform. It was a vision of the future. And now he's exclusively about the past and punishing people who are in his own party who he feels like didn't help him steal the election. So if you're aiming at a general election audience in 2024, he doesn't have very much of an agenda or a promise about how the world would change.
Is anyone still polling Trump's name as a possible presidential candidate to see what the response would be?
I saw some. It's been like a month, and you know, I think the numbers are over 50% of Republicans would support him as a presidential candidate.
Yeah.
Which is not huge. I mean, that's for somebody who has the, you know, far and away the name ID and the, you know, the stature much greater than anybody else. It's not a huge number, but it seems like he probably would win the nomination if it was held today.
Huh? Really? Okay. So if he were to decide not to run, then is there any proper heir apparent? I know that Matt Gaetz was dreaming about this. So I don't think it's going to happen for him now. So who would be the heir apparent if Trump decides not to run?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are sort of kissing the ring in hopes that they will be kissed the ring most fervently and get to be Trump's chosen one. I mean, there's people like Ron DeSantis in Florida, the governor of Florida, who's been very close to him. Also, some former Trump people like Nikki Haley and Mike Pompeo. I think all of them would like to be Trump's anointed, but, you know, it's really hard to, you know, I think it's really hard to, somebody who makes decisions sort of on a whim, you know, it's hard to know who's going to win that primary. If Trump really doesn't run, probably the primary will be about, you know, loyalty to Trump. Is, you know, who is most loyal, who would serve Trump's agenda, who loves Trump the most.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it would be today. Maybe there'll be some huge figure that's not Trump that'll appear in the next year. But if it was held today, it would just be about either Trump or, if he's gone, who sucks up to him the most.
Do you think that Joe Biden has made any inroads with the people that he purports to represent, that being the overlooked white working class?
If you look at Biden's poll numbers now, they're good and very steady. He's polling at about 54% approval, about 39% or 40% disapproval. It's been like two straight lines. So I don't think he's growing his coalition at this point, but he's held it steady, which in American politics right now, when everybody, there's so much partisanship, people get mad at you the second you step in the door, is a pretty good achievement. And I think if he continues to do things like the infrastructure bill that put more money in people's pockets, put his name on highway projects, employ people, I think he has a chance of winning over those voters. I think Biden, in a low-key way, has actually done a pretty good job politically of, like, delivering on his promises and making sure people know who did it.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.